Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be among you today. It's a double honor. You presented me as a geophysicist. Actually, I'm a statistical physicist, but it's a step up to present and to speak in front of mathematicians. So I come in front of you as a very modest person, and you see my mathematics is not that great. We have been trying to develop a view of risks in stock market, inspired and combining the view, the practitioner view, the physicist view, and the mathematical view. So that's a program that was developed during the thesis of my student Yannick Malaverne, who graduated in the end of 2002 and got very nice positions at two financial institutions in Lyon in France, the École of Management and the Institute of the Sciences Financières and de l'Assurance, Insurance and Financial Science in Lyon. So he's an example of a physicist who both learned finance and mathematics and is now teaching and doing his research. And the book is basically an extension of his thesis, which summarizes all the research that we did together and beyond on these measures of risk and how we can put them to application for different problems like portfolio analysis, portfolio management, portfolio optimization, things like that, application to credit risk and so on. So unfortunately, this is not an advertisement for the book because the book is not yet out. It will be out in October only. So it's like an early shot and it will die before it has any effect. Anyway, so the goal today for me is, as I said, to summarize some of the ideas that we have developed and some of the results. And here is the menu that we have in front of us. It's a tough menu. I will actually not cover everything. Almost everything, but not quite. I will start with discussing, it's natural when we think about risk, to discuss the monovariate risk, the marginal distribution, the Pareto, and we are going to discuss the two class of distribution, which are the Pareto versus the strict exponential distribution, and some test application of the two. Then we'll turn to the other dimensions of the risks in portfolios, in a basket of assets, which are the dependence between these assets. And I will remind you what the concept of a copula. I try to introduce it in a very simple and pedagogical way from the physics point of view and then go to the more mathematical point of view. Describe to you how the test that we developed to test this idea of that dependence can be characterized by Gaussian or other copulas like student copulas and so on a real basket of assets. And then I will probably not take the time to discuss about conditional dependence, but there is a very big chapter in the book on this, how you measure in a variety of dimensions the dependence. And I want to stress immediately at that level, at that stage, that in the same way that we have learned over the years, coming from the Gaussian paradigm, that risks cannot be captured adequately by a single dimension, which is the variance or the volatility, but needs to be unfolded in multi dimensions due to the fact that the distribution are non-Gaussian. Therefore, you need to speak about moments or cumulants when they exist, or to speak of other measures of risk. Basically, the risk is a multidimensional problem, and this leads to problems in decision theory, of course, and portfolio, Markovitch approach, etc. Do not work. You need to have a different approach. In the same sense, in the same way, dependences which are simply captured within the Gaussian framework by covariance or correlation coefficients, again, if you have two assets, just a one-dimensional measure of dependence, you need to extend this to, in principle, an infinite dimensional space of measure of dependences when you exit from the Gaussian world. So that's why you need these different diagnostic of dependence, which are all embedded in the Coppola framework. And you can, this Coppola framework offers a very interesting way of characterizing those measures of dependence which depend specifically on the Coppola, namely which are independent of the marginal, and those which are dependent on the marginal. For example, the correlation coefficient is a bad measure of dependence because it's a mixture of the signal coming from the marginal distributions or the monovariate distribution and the real dependence. I will then go on to describe how, for example, we can put to practical tests the use of some of the dependence measures associated with copulas, like tail dependence, the concept of a tail dependent coefficient, within the framework of factor models, and how we can systematically calculate the tail dependence of portfolios within factor models and test that empirically. And then, if I have time, I will spend the remaining part of my talk describing some large deviation results on portfolio theory, the extending portfolio theory, both for first independent assets and then going to the more involved case of dependent assets within the model of this so-called stretch exponential distribution. I should warn you, by the way, that for stretch exponential distribution, there are several words. This stretch exponential wording comes from physics. In mathematics, you call it sub-exponential. In engineering, we call them viable distributions. They're basically exponential of a minus a power law. And when the exponent of the power law is less than 1, of course, the tail of the function is fatter than an exponential. And as I'll show, there are very convenient ways, convenient tools to use for both theoretical and for theoretical point of view and applications. And we'll see application to VAR, to the value at risk problem. So when we look, so let's start with the program we have in front of us. And please interrupt me and ask questions so that it's more lively and I know how to adapt to the audience. If you have any doubt or anything you want to ask, or if my presentation is not clear. So this is a typical time series. You see time and on the abscissa and the return, here in this case, daily returns of the Dow Jones over 7 years of data. And the big slide corresponds to the distribution of returns. So how many times, it's a density distribution, how many times you find a given return. The returns have been scaled to the standard deviation, so that you can compare the distribution, the PDF, probability density function, of the returns at different time scales. You see the top curve corresponds to returns at the time scale of 10 minutes, so it means the return relative price variation from now to 10 minutes in the future, while the bottom curve corresponds to the distribution of returns at the monthly scale. Okay, so usually, and it's not often that we see simultaneously many scales like that. What is interesting is that you see in this log linear scale a progressive change of structure from what we can call something that is fatter or heavier tail than an exponential. You see the upward curvature. An exponential distribution would be qualified by a straight line, by two straight lines, if you like, in this representation. So you have a regime, a change of regime from a straight exponential to with the upward curvature to something which is much more like a parabola, which in this log linear scale qualifies something which is close to a Gaussian. Okay, so you have this progressive transition from a fat tail to a light tail going from small scale to light. And so this is a problem that I will not discuss in my talk, which is very interesting, which is to understand the correlation structure of the volatility that is underlying this progressive change. What I'm going to describe is models, are models at a given time scale, which are, for example, of interest to practitioners, which are, for example, the daily time scale or the weekly time scales. I'm going to discuss rapidly two main models. The first class of models is known under the heavy class of distribution, which are also called Pareto, I mean, comes from Pareto distribution, which are power laws multiplied by slowly varying functions, so that their tail are asymptotically power laws. And there is a lot of empirical work suggesting that the tails are more or less described by such class with exponents, tail exponents of the order of 3 to 4. There is another class which has been proposed perhaps more recently, which is this Weibull-like or stress exponential class of distribution, which is, as I said, an exponential, a slowly varying function, and a power. And this turns out that both do a very good job at fitting the data, as I'll show, and it's a very interesting problem of trying to distinguish the two classes because, for obvious reasons, the consequences are important mathematically. Here in the first class, the moments of order and cumulants of order larger than mu do not exist mathematically, while here all moments exist and all cumulants exist, so that in extension of postural theory, multi-moment, so-called multi-moment extensions of postural theory can be developed for this class of distribution and require different tools for that class of distribution, precisely because the moments do not exist above order mu. So the big question is really, do we need Pareto distribution or not? So there are practical consequences. If you, as a practitioner, you choose one or the other model to characterize the large risk and put that into your risk management process. Obviously, in the way, for example, the large quantile or the small quantiles behave asymptotically for VARs at high significant values. And as I said, there are important applications for multi-moment pricing methods. From a theoretical point of view, or from a mechanistic point of view, of course, the type of process that give rise to the class of power laws or Pareto laws or to the class of Weibull distribution are quite different. So depending on, so that's a domain of investigation which is quite interesting too, because finding or choosing one class of model will have some implication on the underlying dynamics of the system. So you could say, and this was a claim about 9-10 years ago, that the issue was closed, that the marginal risk, the distribution of returns can be defined by using the apparatus of extreme value theory. In extreme value theory, you have this Jelenko theorem, which says that if you take, you know, a set of n returns, then you have a specific statement telling you what is the distribution of the largest return among the n values, okay? And it's captured by this equation h of sub psi of x, which tells you that the distribution of the largest value in absolute value, let's say, so the worst negative loss, for example, is asymptotically given when the limit exists in the limit of large number of variables, and up to a rescaling and a translation, is given by this expression where psi can take different values. Zero corresponds to the famous Gumbel distribution, and you have positive and negative values corresponding to the Fréchet or the Weibull distribution. Okay, but in practice, that's nice, but I would say this is the sex of the angel. Because in practice, you have finite side effects. So as physicists, that's where I put back my physicist hat, cap, is that you have finite side effects. Any finite time series is finite. Typically, for practical application, you have maybe a few years of data. You don't want to go back too far, I mean, depending on your application, because of non-stationary effects and things like that. And so you don't have the luxury of having huge database. And so you have this kind of thing that, for example, if you start from this class of sub-exponential Weibull distribution with exponent c, which is less than 1, and you look at what is the empirical extreme value distribution that you get for the largest value, you'll get that for quite significant size of the data, you'll get the impression that psi is positive, namely that the system obeys obey the theorem and converge to the Fréchet distribution characterized by a power law. Well, actually, if you were to increase the data, maybe it should converge to the Gumbel distribution, because actually the theorem tells us that only power laws, tails, which should converge to the Fréchet class, while any other thinner tail should converge to the Gumbel distribution. And this graph illustrates the idea. This is a synthetic generation on a computer to generate a synthetic time series of returns, or just a set of n random variables distributed according to the stretch exponential distribution with an exponent c, which is 0.7, so slightly fatter than exponential. C equals 1 corresponds to a pure exponential. So c equals 0.7 here and 0.3 here, much fatter here than here. And what is shown in the ordinate is the maximum likelihood estimate of this tail exponent, this xi. By the way, 1 over xi is nothing but the tail exponent of the Pareto distribution. So what you see as a function of the size of the sample. And you see that you have to go to extraordinarily large sample size in order to get what you know you should get asymptotically, which is xi should go to 0. So you have huge effect, and so you have really apparent behavior for huge sample size. So that's a big worry in statistical tests and calibrating of models. So I'm going to present some results pitting the two classes of models on real data to try to get some conclusion, having in mind such some of the traps. And we have two rather big papers in press explaining how extreme value theory tests are extremely weak, very poor diagnostic strength to distinguish between the different classes like those, and that we need to develop better tests in contradiction with previous publication where things seem to be settled. So I'm going to just show you a few of the results based on this type of data, Dow Jones, daily over a long time series, and NASDAQ 5 minutes, so to show just the variety, that the results that we obtain are robust respect, you know, to time scales, to types of data. We do some pre-processing, of course, for the intraday data to remove the so-called lunch effect, which is summarized by this graph showing that as a function of time during the day, you have the volatility which has this U effect, and you want to remove this. Actually, we did our test on both the raw data and this data corrected for the lunch effect and found basically the same result. But okay, so this is a typical plot of the complementary cumulative distribution of the returns for the Dow Jones daily data. For positive and negative, the negative tail has been followed on the same one and is shown in dashed line. And I just put here the equation for the Pareto distribution we're going to test, which is just given by 1 minus x over some scale to the exponent b, and the viable distribution, there should be an exponent c here that doesn't appear, I think, problem of color in the screen. So one main realization that we got that allowed us to develop an interesting, rigorous statistical test to pit the two models was the realization, which to my knowledge was not known until that time, that the Pareto class is actually embedded asymptotically in the stretch exponential class. And so you see roughly the Porcelain derivation of this. If you start from the stretch exponential expression, you see a power law factor, prefactor, which is not important, exponential minus x to some power c, and you take the limit where c, the exponent, goes to 0. So, of course, you can imagine c goes to 0, it should give a very fat tail. You can show that when c goes to 0, given that c times the scale divided by the characteristic value d, so u is like a threshold, it's like upper threshold statistics, when c times u over d to the c goes to a constant while c goes to 0, so taking this limit, given that the other limit is true, then just by a very simple series of manipulation, you find that the stretch exponential converges to the Pareto distribution. So that's very interesting, because you can actually use this type of argument to develop a systematic statistical test and pro-theorem showing that the standard Wilks statistic of the ratios of the likelihood, and actually the log of the ratio of the likelihood, obeys the standard xi-squared distribution of one, with one degree of freedom here in that case, because one, the Pareto distribution class is embedded in this exponential distribution class, which just removing one parameter, with one parameter less. And so that's very interesting because you have, you can bring to the front the power of embedded test hypothesis methods rather than the difficult problem of testing non-nested hypothesis, right? So here we have found a way to nest apparently two classes of models which were not nested. And this led to the development of a sequence of tests. I'm just going to summarize very rapidly in a, wow, some color disappear. So this should be this should be green and should be a strip like this. So apparently there's a problem with the color. Some symbols disappear. So this graph summarizes the main results of all the tests we did, say that if you look at the quantile along the tail of the distribution, you find that the Vibles class explains from approximately 70% all the way to the tail, so that's the quantile, while the Parallel subclass, if you like, which is nested within it, just explains a smaller interval from 90% to the very tail. And since this one is embedded in the viable class, or the exponential class, of course, in this region, the two are almost indistinguishable. So the question of what is the best way to characterize tail is basically undecidable. And one way to realize that, for example, is to look at how the characteristic and the main exponent vary as a function of the quantile. For the Parallel case, you are interested in the tail exponent, and you see that as a function of the quantile, when you go more and more in the tail, you have an exponent which is apparent, which is not true asymptotic, and may in some data set never asymptotically converge. In the same way, for the Vibles class or the stretched exponent class, the exponent C does not converge either, or maybe may converge with large fluctuation to zero, suggesting maybe a conversion to Parallel. So here it's another view of the reconstruction of the B value for different sets, different time scales of the Standard & Poor's 30 minutes and Dow Jones daily and NASDAQ 5-minute time scales as a function of the depth of going more and more in the tail here, where you see an apparent exponent which might converge but with huge fluctuation. Here with you see the range between 3 and 4, which has been reported previously in the literature. But our work concludes that it's essentially impossible to conclude what is the asymptotic tail. And this has important consequences for the risk assessment. Before I explain this, this table just is put to give you from this sample that I've been speaking about the value that we recover by maximum likelihood estimate for the parameter C, the scale parameter stress exponential, and this ratio that should converge when C goes to zero to the exponent of the Pareto distribution. And we show in the last column the Pareto exponent that is obtained directly by maximum likelihood. So you can have small c's, you see, very, very small exponent in the exponential, even ridiculously small d values, but this ratio gives extremely good estimation of the b value, illustrating in a Postman way, I mean, quantitatively, indeed, that this embedding of the Pareto distribution stress exponential family work very well quantitatively. But anyway, so the problem is to distinguish the two, what are the tails, and we cannot. The stratified exponent class might underestimate the tail risk. The Pareto distribution might overestimate the tail risk. And you put numbers for reasonable value at risk, for example, or shortfall values, you find that there are quite and sometimes strong differences in the estimation of the risk. There is actually an additional problem that I want to mention, that we have looked at distributions of returns at fixed time scales, 5-minute intervals, hourly, 30 minutes, daily, etc. But as investors, because I think that we always need, in order to do statistical analysis and mathematical models, we always need to be guided by what are the underlying mechanisms, what people do, because fundamentally the stock market is coming from the behavior of investors. Investors do not care really about returns and their distribution at fixed time scales. What do they care is about tops of the markets and bottoms of the markets. We call them drawdowns and draw ups. They are worried when you have a sequence of losses. They might be unlucky by buying at the top and selling at the bottom. That's really what is hurting. Not the fact that you have fluctuation of plus or minus 1 or 2, 3%. What is really important is this top to down and down to top. And this gives rise to the idea of looking at another statistics, which is the statistics, again, of one-point statistics, but this object, which are not fixed time-scale returns, but variable time-scale returns, which are drawdowns. So this is shown here, and the panel is not very good, but should, maybe you can see it. So this is, I think, Dow Jones as a function of time. This is a crash, actually, which lasts 2 weeks. And this is a top, this is down, this is a kind of drawdown. Okay, so what we do, we define drawdowns are runs of negative losses, and we measure this cumulative loss until it ends and is followed by a up. When you look at this statistic, so this statistic is a mixture, in a sense, of one-point statistics, I mean real returns, and what I would call transient dependence. You know, if you have a crash, you have something that, to take an extreme case, you have maybe an enhancement of the negative correlation that give rise to an acceleration of the dip. So maybe you are measuring with these drawdowns a mixture of these one-point statistics of return together with the possible occurrence of local correlations or local dependencies along the time series. Anyway, when we look at the data, the red line is the estimation of the body of the distribution, 95% of the whole distribution of these drawdowns are explained by basically the what you would calculate from allowing variable lifetime for drawdowns. So you can calculate it from just knowing the initial distribution at fixed time scale. But you see there are wings here, which I call outliers or kings or black swans. And when you do, I have no time because this is a whole subject itself, but when you do the statistical analysis of these wings, you can convince yourself with rigorous tests. So this is a superposition of 30 major U.S. companies showing the distribution of drawdowns. The numbers that you see are in persons, minus 5, minus 10, minus 15, minus 20%. Similarly, in the previous graph, this was a minus 20%, minus 30% drawdown. And of course, I show here for symmetry reason, but they are not exact symmetry, a plus 10%, plus 20% draw up with a similar symmetric idea of measuring ups separated by downs. So we see these kind of tails, and the question is, are they statistically significant? You can do your homework and do a variety of tests, and you find that the probability that you go sufficiently far in the tail for large quantile, 99 and beyond, that the probability that the tails can be explained by a continuation of the bulk of the distribution characterized by the bulk is extremely small. So you have this additional problem. So it's really a mess. It's really difficult to really have good models. I wanted just to point that out to you. I will not go on in this direction, and we'll continue my discussion on this other dimension of risk, which are the dependencies. So let's look at a very simple first approach, two time series. Here I take the Swiss franc and the Japanese yen. This is a top view. You see points corresponding to the density of occurrence. It's just a representation of the bivariate density distribution of the return. So 1 point, I can look at the abscissa. This corresponds to a minus 3%. A variation of the Swiss franc, and this corresponds to a minus 2% variation of the Japanese yen, for example. Okay, so each point corresponds to these two coordinates, to the two values of the return, the joint distribution. Okay. The lines correspond to non-parametric ways of estimating equi-levels of the distributions. For those of you who know about elliptic distribution, Gaussian distribution, you should be already shocked, because the equi-line should be ellipses, right? You don't see ellipses. This is another structure. Now, the projection of this bivariate distribution along one axis or the others, of course, correspond to integrating along this direction and gives rise to the observation of the marginal distribution. Just a convenient way of showing how marginals are obtained from the bivariate distribution. And of course, you see, for example, the Japanese yen distribution, which is in this log linear scale. So this is the return, this is the ordinate, which gives the value of the density. A Gaussian distribution would be this parabola, and you see that actually the data is much fatter and has the inverse temperature. This trajectory gives just as a function of time the value of the Japanese yen. Okay, just to have in a synoptic way all the information. And similarly, you see here by projection of this bivariate distribution, the marginal distribution of the returns of the Swiss franc, by the way, against the dollar, I should have said. Everything is against the US dollar. Okay, this is the trajectory of the Swiss franc as a function of time, and the distribution is again much fatter tail than the Gaussian. So when you start from this, how do you model this for risk assessment and portfolio, etc.? One thing that you can do, which is quite natural, is that since we know how to deal with Gaussian, you can make a nonlinear transformation to map the marginal distributions, each of the two marginal distributions, onto Gaussians. So as you know, you can always do that by a monotonous chance of eyeball, and I'm just showing the principle graphically. If you start from any distribution, you can basically construct a chance of eyeball, which is this curve, so that the probability by the chance of eyeball is conserved and is mapped to the Gaussian distribution. And that gives you the change of variable that you need for this inversion. So you can do that for the two marginal, and that's another way of looking at the change of variable on the cumulative distribution. What you obtain from this bad-looking data here, you know, this beam, which is like mutated beam, you obtain a nice ellipsis, and you obtain, of course, by construction, Gaussian distribution for the marginal, which is not a surprise because you have used the transformation to get Gaussian. What is interesting, and so let me give you another example, Japanese yen again and the Malaysian ringgit, emergent market, okay, exhibiting also wild distribution, wild tails, very non-elliptical bivariate distribution. You do this Gaussian transformation, and the marginal, of course, are very good. There is a little problem at the tip, which comes from the fact that the small values are treated differently, and the bivariate is much better. Now, you can test this by, for example, some standard chi-square test, for example, counting the density within ellipses of a given level, and this is the test that you obtain for six pairs of currencies before the transformation, after the transformation. So it shows that already transforming the marginals into Gaussians, marginals are highly non-Gaussian, right? That should be clear. I transfer them in Gaussian variables, and then we see that a measure of the distance to the bivariate Gaussian is given by the distance from this chi-square curve, if you like, away from the diagonal, and the strip here corresponds to the 95% confidence. And we see that it's not perfect, but it's much better than the raw data. If I do this test for the raw data, where the distribution bivariates are very far from multivariate Gaussian, I see huge variation. So just by mapping the marginal to Gaussian, I get much closer to a multivariate Gaussian. And my So my simple way to introduce copula is through this idea of performing, in the example I'm going to speak first and then elaborate upon and enlarge, is to, well, say we want to deal with Gaussian variable because you can do a lot of calculations. And then we are to deal with the dependence of the nonlinear variables that we have to deal with, which have Gaussian distribution, which are nonlinearly related to the initial returns. Now, the maximum entropy principle just tells you, it's a natural principle to invoke, tells you that you don't... almost a crash. You want to characterize the dependence assuming the minimum amount of additional information, right? So the minimum amount of information you could think of is to calculate the covariance matrix of these nonlinear variables, nonlinear in terms of the return, which are the first non-trivial multivariate cumulants, if you like, or moments that capture something about the dependence. And so working on with these nonlinear variables, we just estimate the covariance matrix. This inverse gives us this expression for the multivariate distribution in the transformed nonlinear variables, which translated back in the returns give this, where the y are these nonlinear variables. So this gives a procedure. And just for the story, when I imagined this, I was not yet aware of all this beautiful mathematical apparatus of copulas. It turns out that what I've described to you is just in a really poor man's way, using the true marginals, I mean a good calibration of the marginals that take into account the fat tail structure, very far from Gaussian, and using what we call the Gaussian copula. What I've done is using the Gaussian copula. So that's the Porsman introduction. Let me now be a bit more systematic. So what is a copula? A copula is mathematically a function. I apologize, I spent a few minutes to remind you what is a copula for those of you who don't know what it is. So it's a function, so you deal with n random variables, n returns, n assets with their return time series. It's a function which maps O1 until O1 to the power n for each of the random variables until the interval O1. And it enjoys the following properties. It's such that, so it's a function of n random variables, and if all the variables except one are one, then this copula is just equal to the variable itself. If one of the variables is equal to zero, this function is zero. And it must be grounded and increasing, which means that basically the C volume in any non-zero subvolume in 0, 1 to the n should be positive. So what does it mean? What is it useful? It is useful due to the following theorem, which is well known since the 1970s. Theorem, it says that if you start from any n-dimensional distribution function, so typically my bivariate distribution in the example of the exchange rates, the currencies, with continuous marginals, then there is, and that's important, continuous marginal gives a unique n-copula such that the multivariate distribution is the copula of the marginals. So if I dare this word, I would say the copula makes the marginal to copulate, right? So that's a way. So you, it doesn't mean that knowing the marginals, you can reconstruct the multivariate distribution. You, of course, need the information of the copula. So if you have the marginals, and of course you can express the inverse, and you have the multivariate distribution, then this function defines the copula, which is just the other way of rewriting this in the other sense. Now, why is copula? Why are copulas interesting? This is due to the invariance theorem. This invariance theorem tells you that if you make an arbitrary, monotonous, positive change of variables, and which can be different from one variable to the next, then the copula of these new variables is the same as the copula of the previous variables. Which means that the copula captures the intrinsic dependence between the random variables, while all the variability of each independent variable is captured by the marginal. So you have a way through this decomposition of the multivariate distribution through the monovariate distribution and the copula to basically have, in quotation mark, an orthogonal decomposition between in the risk associated with the marginals and the risk associated with the pure dependences. Now, what is the Gaussian copula that I've introduced to you very simply? Well, so using this expression here, if you know the expression of the n-dimensional multivariate Gaussian distribution, and of course the monovariate Gaussian distribution, you obtain the copula, the Gaussian copula under this expression. And so, for example, the Gaussian copula density is simply the standard form that we know, the exponential of the quadratic form. Now, the point is that this row is, or entering this formula, is the covariance matrix, but not of the row return, right? It's the covariance matrix of, so it's a characteristic of the dependence of the returns, and it is the covariance matrix of the nonlinear variable derived from the returns, so that in this variable the distribution becomes a Gaussian. So the main advantages is that from a practical point of view, they are easy to handle in high dimension, they account for this non-exclusion risk, they involve a few parameters if you take a parametric view, and they allow a robust estimation of the dependent structure. So, of course, financial theory relies on not only Gaussian copulas, but also Gaussian marginals. Here, this allows to keep the Gaussian copula together with non-Gaussian marginals to account for the large risk that we find everywhere. And this can improve on these models by keeping the Gaussian copula, allowing a lot of calculation to be feasible analytically while allowing for the large risk. But also we can improve on the Gaussian copula hypothesis, and I'll mention this along the discussion. So there are some problems with keeping the Gaussian copula hypothesis for the returns, which is, for example, that you may be interested in the very large risk. And I define here what is called the tail dependence coefficient, which is this probability that one variable, one return, becomes larger than a quantile, that the value at the level quantile u, which is equivalent to saying that this, look at the probability that the return is larger than its var value at the level u, given that the other variable is itself larger than its var value, value choice value, at the same quantile u, and you take then the limit u to go to 1 or to 0, depending on which tail you are interested in. So this tail-dependent parameter may have a non-zero asymptotic value, or it can have a zero value. For the Gaussian copula, independently of the tail, you show that this lambda goes to zero, is zero. No tail dependence. And you understand what it means? Intuitively, it means that asymptotically, if one is very, very, in one value is very, very large, this does not really impact or influence the large realization of the other value. Now, there is another class of copula derived from a class of multivariate distribution, the student class. So once you have the student multivariate distribution, the student marginal distribution, you can construct, as I showed, the student copula, and you can actually calculate analytically, as the expression is given here, this tail dependence parameter as a function of this correlation coefficient involved in the student copula, and for the different curves correspond to the different degrees of freedom of the student copula, which are also controlling the tail exponents of the student copula. And you find that you have a non-zero value. For example, if you find a value 0.5, this is very important. It means that given that one of the variables has sustained a very large shock, there is a 50 probability that this entrains a large shock on the other variable. Okay, so for portfolio application and for portfolio risk, this is very, very important. So time is going fast, so I need to accelerate a bit. And I want to present very fast some tests, because the big question is, we know that Gaussians are bad representation of marginal risks, But what about Gaussian copilot? What about the dependence? And so here, this is a test, and you can show that looking at this quantity, so you take the marginals of the return, so you have a multivariate basket of assets, you look at the returns, xi, you look at that marginal, fi of xi, you calculate the covariance matrix rho of the nonlinear variables which have their Gaussian marginals, so it's not again the covariance matrix of the returns, but the covariance matrix of the modified variables, and you form, and so the, and phi is the standard cumulative Gaussian distribution. You form this product and this sum, and you show that this Z2 is nothing but xi squared distribution with n degrees of freedom. So you can then put in standard test, you can estimate this, and so this is just a description of how you estimate the different quantities involved in the test, and we have a battery of measures of quality for this chi-square distribution. We can use the Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, the average Kolmogorov, the Anderson-Darling test, which are different measures of distance between distribution. And so, to make a long story short, we want also to compare with the student distribution, which I recall the expression of. So you have the student copula here. You are worried by the power of the test, namely the possibility that a student copula could be mistaken for Gaussian postula. So this table has a lot of information, but it tells you that what is very intuitive is that only for parameters, number of degrees of freedom of the student copula, which are relatively small, like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and for significant correlation coefficient of this nonlinear variable, that indeed the student copula will be largely different from the Gaussian copula. So we have been worried about a lot. Again, in the same way that the stress exponential is very hard to distinguish from the Pareto distribution, non-Gaussian copulas can be very hard to distinguish from the Gaussian distribution, depending on what would be the real parameter. So we have made a lot of tests to say, well, suppose that the real model is a student copula, far from the Gaussian, but with some different parameters. For most of the tests, they might be mistaken from the Gaussian copula. Taking into account all this precaution, let me flash the results. We did tests on all these assets, currencies, commodities, stocks, and we found that for commodities, the Gaussian copula is strongly rejected. While for other assets, like currencies, we find this fraction of pairs which are compatible. We cannot be rejected. We cannot be rejected respect to the Gaussian copula hypothesis, which is compatible with other works that has been published in the meantime, showing that the student copula might bring some interesting additional information compared to the Gaussian copula. And similarly for the stocks, you see a majority of the pairs of stocks can be found compatible with the Gaussian copula. Okay, so now I want to present to you in the 5-10 minutes remaining one of the interesting more quantitative model construction that you can make, which is to use this construction together with factor models of finance. I remind you the definition of the tail dependence parameter, which is, by the way, I forgot to stress that point, it's a pure copula property, in contrast with the correlation coefficient. I said at the beginning, the correlation coefficient is a measure of dependence, which is mixed up by the fact that it's also corrupted by the marginal distribution. The tail dependence is a pure copula property, and you see the explicit expression. You know the copula, you know the tail dependence. So lower the coefficient of upper tail dependence, and you can, for example, in some cases, for elliptic distribution, calculate this tail dependence. And we are going to compare the results of calibration to basket of stocks from compare the elliptic models to the factor model. Factor model assumes that, for example, you can regress each stock return respect to a market. A market can be an index, for example, and you have a residue. So, typically, when you look at currencies or stocks, and you want to calibrate with children copula, by the way, and that's an interesting reference, you find this type of degrees of freedom or exponents, you find this kind of values for the correlation and this kind of value for the tail dependence. So quite significant tail dependence for the currencies, much smaller tail dependence for the stocks. Again, this means that you have a 30% probability that given one currency crash, that the other one crashes. Here you have only a 2.5% probability that given one stock crash, the other crashes. Very drastic difference. So this slide summarizes the main results of quite lengthy calculations, which actually are exact. You start from the factor model, saying that each stock can be regressed with respect to a market. So this is a return of the stock, and you write this as a vector for your basket of returns, basket stock. This is a market, and beta is a vector, and epsilon is a vector of residues. This is what you obtain for the tail dependence of between X and Y, given the fact that the factor model works. And this is given by 1 over the maximum of 1 and L over beta. So this is for stock I, the dependence between stock I and the market. So this tail dependence coefficient is a function of the beta, naturally, and a function of the exponent of the marginal distribution of each variables, and the function of the third parameter, which is the limit for large quantile of the inverse of these two quantities, just the limit of the ratio of the two quantiles at level u when it goes to one. Now, there are several cases. The interesting case is when the tail exponent of the marginal distribution for both the market and the stock are asymptotically the same. Then you have a non-trivial expression for this. You can show that it has this dependence. Well, of course, when the exponent of the market is larger than the exponent of the residue, asymptotically, the tail of X is governed by the tail of epsilon, and so since epsilon is not dependent on Y, you have asymptotic dependence, naturally. And the other case, when the tail of Y is dominating respect to the tail of epsilon, you have 100% value for the tail dependence. That's very natural. And generalizing is very easy to show that the tail dependence between two assets, where you have all the assets which can be regressed according to a factor model like that, with different betas, are simply the minimum of each of the tail dependence with the market. That's quite intuitive. So this is the type of calculation you can make, comparing the factor model, assuming a student distribution for the marginals, in contrast with the elliptic model. Now, so you can do an estimation so we can estimate the exponent from the Starnard Hill estimator. You can estimate this L parameter by basically looking at this order statics ratio. You can plug into this formula and obtain, and so just this curve before I got to the result, showing that this L, this ratio of the order statistics, do converge to something which is more or less stable for the large order statistics, so that you can have some confidence. So this is the data. I don't have time to discuss the properties of this data. So these are 20 different of the largest companies in the U.S. for which we have calculated the tail dependence, both for the negative tail and the positive tail, assuming, to check the robustness of the estimation, 3 different values of the tail exponent for the power law distribution of the marginal, in the range which is often reported in the literature, 3, 3.5, and 4. And so you see tail dependence, for example, for Dupont de Nemours, in the range of, 0.3 to 0.4, very strong tail dependence, and some other stocks are much weaker tail dependence. So this is a tail dependence between each of these stocks and the Standard & Poor's 500. This is for the period, for first period from 62 to 79. Interestingly, if you look at another period from 80 to 2000, and I outline one of the companies, you see that I had almost 40% coefficient here. It's almost half the value. So there is a non-stationarity. This table shows how well this modeling predicts actually the events in the market. So you see here in the two periods, the estimated tail dependence according to the factor model and all that, you see actually the realization of this joint extreme event. So what we did was we looked at the 10 largest drops in the market, the Standard & Poor's index. We looked at the 10 largest drop in each of the companies, and we counted how many times we could find a coincidence. Okay, and so the how many times of this coincidence are the numbers here. And the p-value is just the binary probability that this occurrence is compatible with the prediction. And so we find that except for a few cases which are underlined, you see the probabilities are neither large nor small, so it means that indeed the theory is explaining quite well the simultaneous occurrence of these extreme events, both in the stocks and in the stock market, and for both periods. There are a few exceptions, and when we remove the crash of October 1987, we improve significantly even the agreement, which is another story. So let me take 2 more minutes to finish and presenting an application to portfolio theory now. And I have only two or three slides, and I'll finish. The idea is, well, we can maybe use, but this is just an example in a much larger framework of how you want to analyze and optimize your portfolio. But I'm just showing you a very simple idea. Endowed with the knowledge of this tail dependence as a qualifier of the risk that you have in your market, in the same way as with Markowitz, you have the variance. Here I have the tail exponent, the tail coefficient. I can play with the idea of saying, well, I'm going to, from this basket of assets, I'm going to construct two portfolios, the blue portfolio and the red portfolio. The blue portfolio is made of 4 assets which have the smallest tail dependence with the market. In Standard Finance, I would say I want to construct a portfolio with small beta. But not really small beta, because it's there is a lot of stuff, there's a lot of extremes here. I want to have the smallest tail dependence between my portfolio and the market portfolio. And the other market, the red one, picks up the assets which have the largest tail dependence. Okay? So I pick up these two. You can calculate actually in portfolio with the weights what will be the tail dependence. Given, for example, so it's a power law distribution for each asset return distribution. You can calculate the factor, scale factor, as they are called. The exponent is the same for all assets, and you get the tail dependence for the portfolio with the respect to the market return, which has noticed, interestingly and unsurprisingly, an expression which is of the same structure as would be the standard correlation coefficient in the standard mean variance portfolio approach, except that you see the square is replaced by the index alpha of the power law distribution of the distribution, as you expect in the stable law theory of stable laws, and the variance is just replaced by the scale factor characterizing the power law distribution of marginals. So when you do that, and you can plot, for example, the portfolio daily returns, so the blue one and the red one, as a function of the Standard & Poor's, and this is a standard plot, for example, when in test of the CAPM, the Capital Asset Pricing Model. And what do you find, interestingly, that you find that the blue portfolio, unsurprisingly, has less dependence respect to the Standard & Poor's, has been constructed to have much fewer large drops, but also has fewer large gains, because the two extreme dependence are correlated, and comes with a very low cost in terms of global return. So it turns out that, for example, in a simple example, you have much better bargain in picking up the blue respect to the red. So I want to stop here and go to the conclusion, which is that I've tried to present to you this idea that we have now opened the Pandora box, going away from the mean variance approach and mean variance measures of risk. We have this Pandora box of an infinite number of risk factors for the marginals. You have to make some assumption. I discussed the difficulties of asymptotic determination of the large risk of marginal distribution. We have the other Pandora box of the infinite, in principle, number of measures of dependences, but introducing the copula and using a combination of non-parametric and parametric estimations can help characterize in a rather robust way the dependence. And you can use this apparatus to play with a certain number of copula, only copula dependent measure of dependences that can help both characterize and even sometimes develop portfolios with good characteristics with respect to large risk. So I want to stop here, and I apologize for taking a few more minutes. Thank you.